Today's Issues continues on AFR with your host, Ed Vitagliano.
And welcome back to Today's Issues. Here on Tuesday, July 17th, Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman today. Joined in studio by Fred Jackson, News Director for American Family News and One News Now. And in place of Steve Jordahl, Chris Woodward has dropped in, news anchor for American Family News. Good morning slash afternoon, Chris.
Good morning. Steve depending. Is off to write the reboot for Back to the Future.
Yes. Yeah. We were joking around with Steve Jordahl during the just before the break, and he was talking about Back to the Future. So he's gonna write the reboot for that.
Yeah.
I liked the series okay. Mm-hmm. The first one was pretty clever.
Yeah.
You know, when Michael J. Fox showed up in 1950s America, and I'll never forget. You guys remember, I don't think they even have Pepsi Free anymore. Do they have the, remember that was the kind of like diet Pepsi or no caffeine or whatever. But anyway, he walked into that soda place and the guy said, what will you have? And he said, I'll have a Pepsi Free. And
the guy said,
why would I give you a Pepsi Free? He was in 1950s. Yeah. It had some clever stuff
right.
in it. But
yeah.
Anyway, so enough about that.
All right.
That's back to the last segment right there where we were discussing Back to the Future. You see what I did there?
I did.
Back to the last segment.
So clever.
Yes, clever. All right, what kind of news we got? Because we have a guest coming in
a few
minutes.
Something that we've talked a lot about on this program, we've covered it in the news, and we'll continue to cover it, is this universal basic income program idea. This is an idea where a city or a state, a government of some sort, would just give people money, no questions asked. So that way they could pay some bills, they'll have a little bit of a nest egg in addition to the money they bring home from whatever job or jobs they may have. In today's news cycle, there is a Fox News story, the headline being Chicago could soon test universal basic income program. Chicago would be the largest municipality in the U.S. to test a universal basic income program. This pilot program in the Windy City would pay 1,000 families $500 a month. An alderman, whose name is Amia Pawar, recently proposed the idea. No questions asked. The bill apparently already has the backing of the majority of city lawmakers, and the alderman who proposed all this hopes to soon work with Mayor Rahm Emanuel from the Obama administration to implement the pilot program. Interestingly enough, former President Obama, speaking in Johannesburg today, plugged universal basic income. And this thing does have some support from people on the right. They seem to see it as a way we could get off of welfare programs. We could do away with welfare, food stamps, things like that, because you give people some money, not enough to necessarily cover all their bills, but some money, they'll have to go to work and, you know, enjoy their lifestyle, whatever it may be. But then there are other people that say, listen, you know, at some point someone somewhere is going to step up and say $500 a month is not going to cut it. I need a living UBI.
Yes.
The Bernie Sanders of the world, or the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's not an expert in UBI either, I would guess. But what do you guys think?
Universal basic income?
Universal basic income.
Well, first of all, a couple of things. The idea that you can test this concept with 1,000 people in Chicago is ludicrous because you can't test the UBI, again, the universal basic income. You can't test that unless you put a strain, kind of a strain on the system. So a city is going to be able to handle 1,000 people getting $500 mm-hmm. a month. You're not going to be able to decide from that kind of test whether an entire nation can do this or an entire state can do this. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with, well, we're going to have free education, free college for everyone. Well, you can test that with a certain number of students. You're not going to find out whether or not an entire nation can do it until you actually try it out, if it's, you know, theoretically possible. And then the other thing I was just going to say about this is, actually it was a kind of a question, in terms of people on the right, are they saying that it might be a better replacement for welfare and so on and so forth because the machinery of welfare could be done away with? You just simply send a check to somebody. You don't have to have right. an office to go through or files.
Right. The selling point, I'll call it, is this. It would do away with the ginormous amount of money we're giving to people on a per weekly, per monthly, per year basis, things of that sort. And it would not be enough to cover all of their all of their bills. So they would still have to go to work, and everybody would get the money. It wouldn't just go to certain people. That's the reason why some people on the right are in favor of it. But again, other people on the right, I think, have correctly pointed out that someone somewhere is going to say, we need more. And I think it's not crazy to believe that Republicans might actually fall to that, because it would be in an election year and they're trying to get that vote and things of that sort. So they would, I think, cave.
I've given a lot of thought to this. And my answer is no. It's another dumb government idea. I mean, when you know, look at the stories that come out every now and then when there's some honesty in the government, and they talk about the fraud that's in the food stamp program. They talk about the fraud that's in the welfare program. Now you're telling me, hey, now I just get a check in the mail.
Right. But everybody would.
Everybody
gets a check in the mail.
If they were to do this nationwide.
And who's going to decide this test? Who's going to vote against this?
Right.
Hey, listen, once you start giving people money and you're going to say, okay, we don't think it works, we're going to take it away from you. Yeah, that's going to go over like a lead balloon.
Right.
So, I mean, don't start down this. A welfare society does not work. I'm not talking about Social Security, because that's something everybody pays into.
Right.
But when it comes to welfare, and no, I'm not opposed to people getting some help when they're truly down and out.
Right.
You know, you've been on a job for 30 years, you get laid off. Yeah. You deserve some support. Unemployment insurance, again, you pay into it when you're working. I'm not opposed to that kind of thing. But if you're simply going to sit down, I got 1,000 people out there, they're out of work right now, I'm going to write them a check for $500. This idea of a test, forget about it. Like I say, once you start giving people checks and you take it away from them, they're going to be in front of City Hall protesting. The cameras are going to be there. We've seen it over and over again.
I'm not an economic expert. In fact, I'm not an expert on much of anything. Pizza, maybe. Okay, but here's the thing. If everybody gets, let's say we say everybody gets $1,000. Mm-hmm. Now, that's just enormous. That'd be enormously expensive. I don't see how that even our country could pull that off. But if everyone gets $1,000, that doesn't change economic inequality. If that's the point, if the point is to try to help bring the poorest of us up a little bit in the kind of the food chain, if everybody gets the same amount, that doesn't help people at the bottom. If it is just to replace welfare, you know, food stamps, and is this to replace Medicaid? Is this to replace, you know, energy assistance or government housing? I mean, those are huge, monstrous programs. $500 a month is not going to replace those things. What's going to happen, to Fred's point, is it's going to be in addition to everything else that's going to be done. And eventually you may reach the point where people go, well, I don't have to work. You know, I've got my EBT card and I've got Medicaid and I've got government housing and I've got an energy allowance and all these. College is free. And on to boot, I get a free $500 on top of that for spending. I'm just not sure that's going to help anyone get off the government dole.
That's right.
If that's the point.
All right.
So do you have anything else?
I still have some others. You know, obviously, we've talked a lot about football players making the news for all kinds of things in the NFL. There is a New Orleans Saints player in the news today for being a saint and helping rescue a man trapped in a car after a fall from a parking garage. This is 25-year-old Mitchell Lowen. Well, actually, 25-year-old Mitchell Lowen was with his wife and young son when a car fell from the fourth deck of a downtown New Orleans parking garage, the Times-Picayune reported.
You mean
fell off a parking garage. Lowen said the crash sounded like a bomb or an earthquake or something, and he rushed toward the victim. This was actually tweeted by NOLA.com. Saints player helped save trapped man in car that plunged from garage. Driver's legs were pinned down by the car and were stuck in the passenger seat, while his upper body was hunched over the back seat. Nonetheless, this defensive lineman called about 10 people over to help him out. They got him out, and a saint was a saint.
So the person in the car survived?
The person in the car survived. Now, this was looks like it's a Hummer. So, if it was in my car.
This guy put it in the wrong gear, and his car was launched off the fourth story of a parking garage. I think I saw that in a Jason Bourne movie once.
Yeah.
But I didn't know that could happen and you could survive that. But this is a New Orleans Saint. What's the man's name again?
Mitchell Lowen, 25-year-old defensive lineman. It's still unclear how the crash happened and how extensive the man's injuries are. No one else was injured. Lowen is quoted as saying, "It was crazy. It was a life-changing experience." I think we could all agree that is the case.
Mm. Wow. So we have a New Orleans Saint who acted like a saint. And this is good. I like these kind of stories because the NFL got a lot of negative publicity last year because handfuls of the players wouldn't refuse to stand for the national anthem. Most of the players did stand, but there were some who knelt. Mm-hmm. And so I like when we get some stories like this where NFL players.
I'll keep my eyes peeled.
When the Saints go marching in.
Should have borrowed a note from the Jordal file and had that music.
Oh, listen, he's got files for everything now.
He does.
I don't know if you can keep track of it. So, all right, we want to welcome a first-timer here on today's issues on the American Family Radio Network, John Guandolo, who's founder of UnderstandingTheThreat.com. That is a group that provides training for state, federal, and local government officials concerning the threat of the global Islamic movement. And John is a former combat veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, a graduate of the U.S. Army Ranger School. He's got some other stuff available, but just the last part of that, he's got quite a bio. He's a man we want to be nice to. We want this guy on our side. So, John, welcome to today's issues.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you all having me.
Well, and appreciate your service. You have quite a bio. Folks can check it out. We're going to give you an opportunity to talk about some of the things that people can find at your website, UnderstandingTheThreat.com. You also have a book, Raising a Jihadi Generation. That book can be purchased at John's website or Amazon.com. John, let me ask you this. We got Fred Jackson and Chris Woodward here also who will be asking you some questions. Why your interest in warning the West, and especially obviously the United States, about the dangers posed by the Islamic movement?
Well, as an FBI agent, when I was, after 9/11, moved over to the counterterrorism division, through a series of cases that I worked, I became aware of the Islamic movement here in the United States, primarily led by the Muslim Brotherhood. And through these cases, came to understand and see how deeply they were embedded in our national security apparatus, portraying themselves as nice, helpful, wanting to be patriotic people, when in fact we could identify by name all the leaders of the key Islamic organizations as members of the Muslim Brotherhood and all of the key Islamic organizations in the United States as most part of their network, the Islamic Society of North America, Muslim Student Association, Islamic Circle of North America, Muslim Public Affairs Council, Muslim American Society, and all of these are the organizations that primarily are doing outreach to churches, law enforcement, government agencies, and including the Pentagon, giving advice on warfighting strategy and domestic counterterrorism strategy. And so that was shocking. And as I dug into their doctrine and what the Muslim Brotherhood believed, that as an investigator, the natural question is, well, how does what they're pushing differ from Islamic doctrine? And in fact, it does not. The command to wage war against the non-Muslim community is core Islamic doctrine. It's the reason Islam exists, codified in Sharia Islamic law, which comes from the Quran and the example of their prophet Muhammad. What is astounding to me as a guy who I'm a pretty simple man. I was a Marine officer, combat veteran, FBI agent, was recruited out of the FBI to work with the Department of Defense. And as I went around in my capacity as a strategic advisor at the DOD on this issue, I was briefing 3 and 4-star generals and former FBI and CIA directors and literally the chairman of the Judiciary Homeland Security Intelligence Committees, who were not aware of any of this. And it was, to me, it was staggering, the level of ignorance, until I realized that's why the Muslim Brotherhood leaders wore suits and advised our government officials. Because over time, when somebody you think is nice and is working with you and you get to know them and there's a personal relationship then there, and they feed you a completely counterfactual narrative, well, then when the truth comes along, very difficult to deal with. And it's why we've lost the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and why we're going to lose the big war if we don't screw our heads on right and decide to actually defend liberty in this republic.
John, it's Fred Jackson here. Would you describe the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization?
Well, of course. I mean, they're a jihadi organization, but according to U.S. law, they fit the bill of a terrorist organization, yes.
Okay, I asked that question because on your bio here, I see in 2006, you were part of this program to train government people to be sensitive to groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, et cetera, yet a few years later, we had that horrible incident at Fort Hood with Major Assad, and the investigation showed there were people in the government who were aware of his contact with Islamic terrorism organizations, yet he was let go. Do you have any thoughts on how that was able to transpire to the point of that horrific incident at Fort Hood?
Right. That is the outcome of the Muslim Brotherhood strategy. And let me be clear, that training in 2006, I wasn't a part of it. I created it, and I implemented it, and I ran it. I proctored the course. It was the first and only two-week program in the government on these issues, on Sharia and the Muslim Brotherhood, and how knowing this information changes how investigators and analysts deal with this. Now, this is why this is important, because the whole point was to identify the enemy. Our warfighting strategy at the U.S. national security level says when we analyze a threat, we begin with who they say they are and why they're fighting. That's how you analyze a threat professionally. Since 9/11, the U.S. government, in any capacity, has never done that. This enemy 100% says they're Muslims waging jihad to establish an Islamic state under Sharia. Doesn't matter if they're right or wrong, yet you begin your analysis there. And if we began our analysis of the threat there on September 12, 2001, we would have seen that Sharia law exists. They teach it to their children. They teach it at junior high and elementary schools at the highest level of jurisprudence in Islam, and at all the Islamic organizations and mosques in the United States, Europe, Asia, Africa, et cetera, because it's what Islam is. Then we would have had a realistic approach. And then you can answer questions like how to deal with these issues when they come up. But as in the case of Fort Hood with Major Nidal Hassan, instead of saying, addressing this, what you had is a guy who went around and gave approximately 24 briefings where he said, Sharia requires that if I'm commanded to go overseas and fight against Muslims, there will be, quote, adverse action. And then in his brief, he defined what adverse actions were, and he used examples like Sergeant Akbar, the U.S. Army sergeant, who threw a grenade in the tent, killing military officers. So he said, this is the problem. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. Well, they assigned him to deploy overseas. He went to Fort Hood and killed people. I mean, he said he was going to do it. But we said, this is just rhetoric. We don't need to know this. Our advisors tell us there's no real such thing as Sharia law. And so we're not going to look at it. And so Americans continue to be killed because our leaders are professionally incompetent. And in the real world, that's called criminal negligence. And we put doctors and lawyers in jail for that.
John, it's Chris Woodward here. For many years now, dating back to the Obama administration, we as Americans were encouraged to, if we see something, we should say something. But there have been cases where people thought something was suspicious and were afraid to report it because they might be labeled a racist or a bigot or something of that sort. A good example of that was the neighbor of the San Bernardino shooters who thought something weird was going on but didn't want to say anything because the people living next to her were Arabic and she was not. How important is it for people to actually say something if they think it's suspicious, no matter how bad they might feel reporting that?
They have to do it. That's their duty as a citizen. But I want to say that the fact that we're there at a point where when you report something, you're not only labeled a racist or Islamophobe or fill-in-the-blank adjective. Mm-hmm. That is a Muslim Brotherhood campaign. That's their Islamophobia campaign. And that's not just political correctness run amok. That is literally their an information campaign. And so it's important to know that. But it's worse than just being called names. We have now numerous examples. Some have been published in the media, in, you know, like Breitbart or World News Daily, not certainly in on ABC, CBS, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, where we have Americans who have contacted their police or their local FBI office saying, I have a concern about this mosque that they're proposing being built because of XYZ, and the person who calls in the concern is investigated, and a state trooper member of the JTTF shows up at their door and starts peppering them about why are they doing this. So it's not just being called names. The force and the power of the government is coming against citizens who do what I would expect citizens to do. And therein lies the problem. I cannot overemphasize to you and your listeners how bad it is at the federal level, how broken and how incompetent they are when it comes to this this topic.
Our guest has been John Guandolo, who's founder of UnderstandingTheThreat.com. It's a group that provides training for state, federal, and local government officials concerning the threat of the global Islamic movement. John, I have a bunch of questions, but we are almost out of time. We will have you back on today's issues in this network to kind of pick your brain some more. But I want to give you an opportunity to, don't you have a television show that people can, what is it, and what would people see there if they go and visit the website?
Yes, we have. I try to get this message. My objective is to get the message out. We're the only organization in the United States which is teaching citizens and law enforcement about this to the point that we give them tools to actually identify and from a law enforcement perspective, investigate and go after and prosecute these organizations. And at the state level, we're the only ones giving state leaders strategies to dismantle these networks. That's who we are, but it begins with education. So our books and DVDs are very important. They're on the website. We have a lot of free resources on the website about this, but it's all about getting the message out. The TV show is at wvwtv.com, 30 minutes, new show every week. We're getting ready to go back in studio and do another series of these. The first 12 are in the midst of coming out. We have a weekly radio show, worldviewradio.com. But the easiest thing is if your listeners just sign up for our newsletter on our website, I just click the box, they will get links to the radio and TV show so they can do that. And obviously we have two articles come out each week, so you'll get access to all that. But it's all about understanding how dangerous the threat actually is. And that's the most shocking thing.
Hey, John, we are just... we're seconds away from being done with the program. UnderstandingTheThreat.com is your website, right?
Yes, it is, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely. John Guandolo, founder of Understanding the Threat, has been our guest. Our thanks to John for being on. Sounds like lots of hair-raising but important information for you at that website. Well, that's all the time we have for today's issues for today. More great programming directly ahead on the American Family Radio Network. Bye for now.